Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of James Corbett's report on the financial evidence surrounding 9/11. And I'll tell you about our first progressive movie night of 2016 coming up at the end of February. So let's begin with James Corbett.
Perhaps the most frank admission of insider trading is notable for three things. It was recorded on video. It has never been investigated by any agency or law enforcement official, and it was made by former CIA agent and frequent foreign policy commentator Robert Baer, the real-life inspiration for the character portrayed by George Clooney in Syriana. Talking to citizen journalists after a speaking event in Los Angeles in 2008, Baer was recorded on video making a startling assertion about 9/11 insider trading.
And the last thing I'll leave you with is National Reconnaissance Office was running a drill of a plane crash into their building. And you know they're staffed by DOD
and CIA. I know the guy that went into his broker in San Diego and said, cash me out, it's going down tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
That tells us something.
Wow. What?
That tells us something.
Well, his brother worked in the White House.
This truly remarkable statement bears further scrutiny. If Baer is to be believed, a former CIA agent has firsthand knowledge that a White House insider had foreknowledge of the attacks, and to this day not only has Baer never revealed the identity of this person, but no one has questioned him about his statement or even attempted to pursue this lead. So how is it possible that the SEC overlooked, ignored, or simply chose not to pursue such leads in their investigation? The only possible answer, of course, is that the investigation was deliberately steered away from such persons of interest and any connections that would lead back to foreknowledge by government agencies, federal agents, or their associates in the business world. Unfortunately, we will likely never see documentary evidence of that from the commission itself. One researcher requesting access under the Freedom of Information Act to the documentary evidence that the 9/11 Commission used to conclude that there had been no insider trading received a response that stated that the potentially responsive records have been destroyed. Instead, we are left with sources that refuse to be identified, saying that CBOE records of pre-9/11 options trading have been destroyed, and secondhand accounts of traders who had heard talk of an event in advance of 9/11. In a roundabout way, perhaps the 9/11 Commission reveals more than it lets on when it tries to dismiss key insider trades with the pithy observation that the traders had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. If those with foreknowledge of the attacks weren't connected to Al-Qaeda, what does that say about the identity of the real 9/11 perpetrators?
ABC News has now learned that the Chicago Board of Options Exchange launched their investigation into the unusual trading last week. That may have given them enough time to stop anyone from profiting from death here in the U.S. It may also give investigators, Peter, a hot trail that might lead them to the terrorists.
Thanks very much. As a reminder of the complications here, though, the Secretary of the Treasury said today of this investigation, you've got to go through 10 veils before you get to the real source.
Yep.
P-TECH was a Quincy, Massachusetts-based company specializing in enterprise architecture software, a type of powerful computer modeling program that allows large-scale organizations to map their systems and employees and to monitor them in real time. The person running this software has a god's-eye view of processes, personnel, and transactions, and even the ability to use this data to foresee problems before they happen and to intervene to stop them from happening. As a senior consultant working on risk management for J.P. Morgan at the time of 9/11, Indira Singh was looking for exactly this type of software to implement the bank's next-generation risk blueprint. In her search for the ultimate risk management software, P-TECH's name was floated as the best candidate for the task.
I had a good life. I did risk at J.P. Morgan Chase. Just to take a break from all the heavy stuff, what I do was to devise a way to monitor everything going on in a very large company to stop big problems from happening. There is that little cloud there and my very bizarre picture of how I think about this problem. I am a person who was merging two disciplines, risk management and something called enterprise architecture, which is fairly esoteric, But at the end of the day, we seek to prevent large problems from happening anywhere in a large global enterprise. At JP Morgan, I was working on the next generation risk blueprint, which is all about how to prevent these things from happening. Bad business practice, such as money laundering, road trading, and massive computer failures, anything you could imagine would go wrong. I had a lot of leeway consulting as a senior risk architect to think out of the box and actually get my ideas implemented. I was funded out of a strategic fund. I reported to the directors, and I was pretty happy. JP Morgan thought very highly of me, and they were thinking of funding in conjunction with my project in DC, the next generation risk software. What I needed to do, what I did, was a really smart piece of software. Really, really smart. Its job would be to think about all the information. And this is where you may connect a dot. The job of this software would be to think about all the information that represented what was going on in the enterprise at any given time as bank business was being transacted worldwide. For example, it would be a surveillance software that would look for trading patterns that indicated someone was up to no good and then do something about it, send a message somewhere, send the transaction information somewhere, perhaps shut their system down, perhaps shut another system down, perhaps start something else up elsewhere. This kind of capability is very, very essential in today's world. However, this kind of software is not found in Microsoft or not even in IBM. A small group of very esoteric software companies make this kind of enterprise software, and it is very pricey. So you can't afford to pick wrong. And I asked all my colleagues who are industry gurus, what would they recommend for this? My buddies recommended PTEC.
Indeed, it's not difficult to see why PTEC came so highly recommended. Given the nature of this sensitive risk management work, only a company with experience delivering software to large-scale organizations with secrets to protect would fit the bill, and in this regard, PTEC did not disappoint. Their client roster included a veritable who's who of top-level corporate and governmental clients: the FBI, the IRS, NATO, the Air Force, the Naval Air Command, the Departments of Energy and Education, the Postal Service, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Department of Defense, the Secret Service, even the White House. From the inner sanctum of the White House to the headquarters of the FBI, from the basement of the FAA to the boardroom of IBM, some of the best secured organizations in the world, running on some of the most protected servers housing the most sensitive data, welcomed PTEC into their midst. PTEC was given the keys to the cyber kingdom to build detailed pictures of these organizations, their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and to show how these problems could be exploited by those of ill intent. But like all such systems, it could be exploited by those of ill intent for their own purposes, too. Given the nature of the information and secrets being kept by its clients, it should come as no surprise that many of PTEC's top investors and employees were men with backgrounds that should have been raising red flags at all levels of the government. And as it turns out, at least one of these men did raise red flags with a pair of diligent FBI field agents. In the late 1990s, Robert Wright and John Vincent, FBI special agents in the Chicago field office, were running an investigation into terrorist financing called Vulgar Betrayal. From the very start, the investigation was hampered by higher-ups. They were not even given access to the computer equipment needed to carry out their work. Through Wright and Vincent's foresight and perseverance, however, the investigation managed to score some victories, including seizing $1.4 million in terrorist funds. According to Wright,
"These funds were linked directly to Saudi businessman Yassin Qadhi."
Yassin Al-Qadhi is a multimillionaire businessman and philanthropist who, according to business associates, liked to boast of his relationship with former Vice President Dick Cheney. But in the late 1990s, he was sanctioned by the UN Security Council for his suspected links to Al-Qaeda, and after 9/11 he was put on a terrorist watch list by the US Treasury for his suspected ties to terrorist financing. During the 1990s, as Vulgar Betrayal was being thwarted from opening a criminal investigation into his activities, the Qadhi-backed investment firm Sarmony Limited became an angel investor to a software startup called PTEC, providing $5 million of the initial $20 million of capital that got PTEC off the ground. At the time, PTEC's CEO denied that Al-Qadhi had any involvement with the company other than his initial investment, but the FBI now maintains he was lying, and that in fact Al-Qadhi continued investing millions of dollars in the company through various fronts and investment vehicles. Company insiders told FBI officials that they were flown to Saudi Arabia to meet PTEC's investors in 1999, and that Al-Qadhi was introduced as one of the owners. It has also been reported that Hussein Ibrahim, PTEC's chief scientist, was Al-Qaeda's representative at PTEC, and Al-Qaeda's lawyers have admitted that Al-Qaeda's representatives may have continued to sit on PTEC's board even after 9/11. Ibrahim himself was a former president of BMI, a New Jersey-based real estate investment firm that was also one of the initial investors in PTEC and provided financing for PTEC's founding loan. PTEC leased office space and computer equipment from BMI, and BMI shared office space in New Jersey with Qadi International, owned and operated by none other than Yasin al-Qadi. In 2003, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark said, "BMI held itself out publicly as a financial services provider for Muslims in the United States. Its investor list suggests the possibility this facade was just a cover to conceal terrorist support." Suhail Lahir was PTEC's chief architect. When he wasn't writing the software that would provide PTEC with detailed operational blueprints of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. government, he was writing articles in praise of Islamic holy war. He was also fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor and the head of Maktab al-Kidamat, which was the precursor to al-Qaeda. That such an unlikely cast of characters were given access to some of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. federal government is startling enough. That they were operating software that allowed them to map, analyze, and access every process and operation within these agencies for the purpose of finding systemic weak points is equally startling. Most disturbing of all, though, is the connection between PTEC and the very agencies that so remarkably failed in their duty to protect the American public on September 11, 2001.
Could you describe the relationship of PTEC with the FAA? Now, PTEC worked with the FAA for several years, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, they worked the FAA. There was it was a joint project between PTEC and MITRE, and they were looking at, it's interesting, they were looking at basically holes in the FAA's interoperability with responding with other agencies, law enforcement, in the case of an emergency such as a hijacking. So they were looking for the escalation process, what people would do, how they would respond in case of an emergency, and find the holes and make recommendations to fix it. Now, if anyone was in a position to understand where the holes were, PTEC was, and that's exactly the point. And if anybody was in a position to write software to take advantage of those holes, it would have been PTEC.
Now, was there a reference to PTEC having operated in the basement out of the FAA?
Yes. Now, typically, because the scope of such projects are so overarching and wide-ranging, when you are doing an enterprise architecture project, you pretty much have access to how anything in the organization is being done, where it's being done, on what systems, what the information is, and you pretty much have carte blanche. Now, if it's a major project that spans several years, the team that comes in has literally access to almost anything that they want because you're operating on a blueprint level, on a massive scale. So, yes, they were everywhere, and I was told that they were in places that required clearances. I was told that they had log-on access to FAA flight control computers. I was told that they had passwords to many computers that you may not on the surface think has anything to do with finding out holes in the system. But let's say you've said, okay, you isolated a part of a process, of a notification process that was mediated by a computer, and you wanted to investigate it further, then you would typically get log-on access to that computer. And from that back upstream or downstream, so who knows? From my own experience, I could have access to almost anything I wanted to in JP Morgan Chase and didn't. For the reason if anything went wrong, I didn't want to have the access. But if you were up to no good as an enterprise architect with such a mandate, you typically could have anything you wanted.
So who was really behind PTEC? Did Ziadi, Ibrahim, and the others somehow evade the due diligence of all of the government agencies and multinational corporations that PTEC contracted with? Did PTEC just happen to end up working on the interoperability of the FAA and the Pentagon systems on the morning of 9/11? Did al-Qaeda's friend Dick Cheney really know nothing of Qadi's connections or activities? Was this all some devious al-Qaeda plot to infiltrate key systems and agencies of the U.S. government? Not according to the people who were really investigating the company. So what did the 9/11 Commission have to say about PTEC? Absolutely nothing. The co-chair of the commission, Thomas Kane, had been involved in a $24 million real estate transaction with BMI, one of the PTEC investors, but no mention was made of that at the time, and the commission never looked into PTEC or its activities on 9/11. Meanwhile, Cheney's friend al-Qaeda has since been removed from the Swiss, European, UN Security Council, and US Treasury terrorist sanctions lists. And Robert Wright? After Vulgar Betrayal was shut down, the FBI did eventually raid PTAC's offices in December of 2002, but not before the company was given 2 weeks' advance warning of the raid. The very next day, then-Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge declared that PTAC in no way jeopardizes the security of the country. Osama Ziadi is still wanted by the FBI for lying about al-Qaeda's involvement with the company, but the case is now cold.
Now there's an interesting twist to all of this. According to 9/11 researcher Christopher Bolin, the PTAC software company was actually a disguised Israeli intelligence operation. And you can learn more about that by reading Christopher Bolin's latest book called Solving 9/11. And now back to James Corbett.
On September 10th, 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld declared a new war. Not a war on a shadowy terrorist organization in Afghanistan, or even a war on terror itself, but a war on the Pentagon.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
Perhaps it is no surprise that Rumsfeld felt compelled to declare a war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy. The issue of the Pentagon's $2.3 trillion accounting nightmare had been dogging him since his confirmation hearings in January of 2001. Although Rumsfeld was interested in pushing forward a modernization of the military that was projected to cost an additional $50 billion in funding, that agenda was politically impossible in the face of the Department of Defense's monumental budget problem.
How can we seriously consider a $50 billion increase in the defense budget when DOD's own auditors say the department cannot account for $2.3 trillion in transactions in 1 year alone? Now, my question to you is, Mr. Secretary, what do you plan to do about this?
Decline the nomination. Oh, Senator, I have heard...
I don't want to see you do that.
We'll stand adjourned in that case.
Senator, I have heard some of that and read some of that, that the department is not capable of auditing its books. It is, I was going to say, terrifying.
Terrifying only begins to describe the problem. The Department of Defense's own Inspector General report for fiscal year 1999 noted that the Defense Finance and Accounting Service had processed $7.6 trillion of department-level accounting entries in that year. Of that amount, only $3.5 trillion could be properly accounted for. $2.3 trillion in transactions were fudged to make entries balance, run through without proper documentation, or made up entirely. The Inspector General's office did not even examine the other $1.8 trillion in transactions because they did not have adequate time or staff to review them. In 2002, one DFAS accountant blew the whistle on the problem and the cover-up that was underway to stop investigators from finding out where the money went.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and he says, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback, you know. My supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job. So.
He was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
As controller of the Pentagon from 2001 to 2004, Dov Zakheim was the man tasked with solving this problem.
There are all kinds of long-standing rules and regulations about what you can do and what you can't do. I know Dr. Zakheim's been trying to hire CPAs because the financial systems of the department are so snarled up that we can't account for some $2.6 trillion in transactions that exist, if that's believable. And yet we're told that we can't hire CPAs to help untangle it in many respects.
Mr. Secretary, the first time and the last time that Dove Zackheim and I broke bread together, he told me you'd have a handle on that $2.6 trillion by now, but we'll discuss that a little.
You've got a handle, it's just a little hot.
From 1987 to 2001, Zackheim headed SPC International, a subsidiary of System Planning Corporation, a defense contractor providing air warfare, cybersecurity, and advanced military electronics to the Department of Defense and DARPA. SPC's radar physics laboratory developed a remote control system for airborne vehicles that they were marketing to the Pentagon prior to 9/11. Zackheim was also a participant in drafting Rebuilding America's Defenses, a document that called for a sweeping transformation of the U.S. military, including the implementation of the $50 billion missile defense program and increased use of specialized military technologies. The paper even noted how advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Rebuilding America's Defenses was a white paper produced by the Project for the New American Century, a group founded in 1997 with the goal of projecting American global dominance into the 21st century. Joining Zackheim in the group were a host of other neocons who ended up populating the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Jeb Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld. In their September 2000 document, the group lamented that their plan for transforming the military was not likely unless a defining event took place, one that would galvanize public opinion. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor.
We know that the thing that tends to register on people is fear. And we know that that tends to happen after there's a Pearl Harbor. It tends to happen after there's a crisis. And that's too late for us. We've got to be smarter than that. We've got to be wiser than that. We have to be more forward-looking. There's a wonderful book on Pearl Harbor by Roberta Wohlstetter and a foreword by Dr. Schelling that talks about this problem of seeing things happen and not integrating them in your mind and saying, yes, we need to be doing something about that now, that I reread periodically because it's so important.
And on 9/11/2001, America received its new Pearl Harbor. The attack on the Pentagon struck Wedge 1 on the west side of the building. An office of the U.S. Army called Resource Services Washington had just moved back into Wedge 1 after renovations had taken place there. The office was staffed with 45 accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts. 34 of them were killed in the attack. A 2002 follow-up report from the DOD Inspector General on the missing trillions noted that a further $1.1 trillion in made-up accounting entries were processed by the Pentagon in fiscal year 2000, but they did not even attempt to quantify the missing funds for 2001. The Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, later explained they were unable to produce a financial report for 2001 at all due to the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. Before becoming Secretary of the Army, Thomas White was a senior executive at Enron. Enron was one of the largest energy companies in the world, posting a $111 billion profit in 2000, before being exposed as an elaborate corporate accounting fraud in 2001. The SEC, which investigated the Enron scandal, occupied the 11th to 13th floors in World Trade Center Building 7, and their offices were destroyed on 9/11, destroying 3,000 to 4,000 documents on active investigations in the process. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy did not yield the results he promised. By 2013, the unaccountable money in the Pentagon's coffers had reached $8.5 trillion.
The latest scandal to hit Washington comes from a report revealing the Pentagon misplaced $8.5 trillion. Military leaders have also been found ordering subordinates to doctor books to hide the missing money. This is the conclusion of a special report by Reuters. One former Pentagon employee, Linda Woodford, said she spent 15 years there falsifying financial records. Woodford had a job checking Navy accounting records against figures supplied by the Treasury Department. She said money was missing from the report every month.
And national security expert Steve Miles is here with me to help us
crunch these numbers. $8.5 trillion unaccounted for?
It's a lot of money. This is the kind of thing that you would think would bring Capitol Hill to a screeching halt. There'd be hearings kind of almost daily. You'd have various committees looking into it. None of that. It just leads to massive waste, and there can be all sorts of fraud that you don't know about. Just one example, when the Inspector General looked at Iraq, which was, you know, a lot of money, but in the grand scheme, just a portion of the money the U.S. spends. What they found was about $50 billion of the money the U.S. spent there was wasted, and about $6 billion was completely lost. They had no idea where it went. It was completely unaccounted for. But put that in perspective, that's about this amount of money that other countries would spend on their defense in a year total. And that's just the loose pocket change that we lost in the couch.
One thing I found very interesting in this report is that the Pentagon apparently uses a standard operating procedure to enter false numbers or so-called plugs to cover lost or missing information in their accounting in order to submit a balanced budget to the Treasury. So they can write in everything.
I mean, that's probably the most shocking part of this, is that they get to the end of the day and they say, oh, there's money missing. What do we do? Well, we'll just put a number in there that says it's there and we'll sort it out later. I mean, again, this is the type of operating practice that if you did it in your own business, if you tried to do it with your own taxes for the government, they'd haul you off to jail.
But then, given that the trillions have never been accounted for, and given that American defense spending soared to record levels after the attack, perhaps Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon, the one he announced on September 10th, was successful after all. And perhaps September 11th was the key battle in that war.
Some might ask, how in the world could the Secretary of Defense attack the Pentagon in front of its people? To them I reply, I have no desire to attack the Pentagon. I want to liberate it.
Insurance scams and insider trading, electronic fraud and vulgar betrayal, missing money and evidence destroyed. There are at least 8.5 trillion reasons to investigate the money trail of 9/11. Curious, then, that the U.S. government's final word on the attacks, the 9/11 Commission report, concluded that the money trail was not worthy of investigation at all. In Chapter 5 of the report, the Commission noted, "To date, the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. Ultimately, the question is of little practical significance." 9/11 was a crime, and as every detective knows, the first rule of criminal investigation is to follow the money. So why did the 9/11 Commission specifically reject this rule? The answers to 9/11 are not going to come from the suspects of the crime. Instead, it's up to investigators to continue to unearth the true evidence on the 9/11 money trail. Follow the money.
And again, you've just been listening to the second and final part of James Corbett's report on the financial evidence surrounding 9/11. His website is corbettreport.com. If you missed the first part last week, it'll be archived on the wwuh.org website for another week, and then more permanently on the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search for the shows under my name, Cheryl, with a C. And now let me tell you about our progressive movie night. On Wednesday, February 24th, we'll be showing the film Weight of Chains 2. Weight of Chains 2 is the sequel of the popular and controversial documentary film directed by Boris Malagurski, analyzing neoliberal reforms in the Balkans and the effects on politics, economics, military culture, education, and the media in the former Yugoslavia. Through stories of sold-off companies, corrupt politicians, fictional tribunals, military alliances, the film deconstructs modern myths about everything the people have been told will bring them a better life. And the film will be shown in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford, Wednesday, February 24th at 7 p.m. A few years back, we showed the first part of that called Weight of Chains, an excellent film, but you don't need to have seen that in order to appreciate Weight of Chains 2, although it is currently available on YouTube if you wanted to see it. So I hope to see you on February 24th for the first film of our 2016 Progressive Movie Night. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.